thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on Gary Knowles Network, and that is Progressive Radio Network. And you can tune in anytime by visiting the archives, where we have many of our shows, previously aired shows, as well as many of the other shows available for you right here on Progressive Radio Network. So thank you so much for joining us today. We have as our guest today Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, medical doctor. He graduated from Brown University, Phi Beta Kappa, magna cum laude, with a degree in English literature, and he worked as a journalist, first at Time Incorporated, before continuing his studies at Columbia and receiving his medical degree from Cornell University Medical College. I am also a Cornell alumni. During a postgraduate immunology fellowship with Dr. Robert A. Good, considered the father of modern immunology, he completed a research study evaluating an aggressive nutritional therapy in the treatment of advanced cancer. Since 1987, Dr. Gonzalez has been in private practice right here in New York City, where we're broadcasting out of, although I know we're listened to around the country and around the world, and he treats patients diagnosed with cancer and other serious degenerative illnesses. His nutritional research has received substantial financial support from giants such as Procter & Gamble, Nestle, and the National Cancer Institute. Results from a pilot study published in 1999 described the most positive data in the medical literature for pancreatic cancer. On today's show, Dr. Gonzalez will discuss his successful treatment of hundreds of patients, as well as his new book, What Went Wrong? The Truth Behind the Clinical Trial of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Gonzalez.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I do want to go back in time a little bit, and let me let you know that I have been familiar with your work for many, many years, because I worked with Dr. Serafina Corsello. I was her head nurse for about 23 years, and she actually did have many of your patients coming also into our office for various therapies and nutritional support, and we were astounded at how well some end-stage cancer patients did under your therapies.
Well, thank you for those kind words. Serafina certainly was a great, great doctor, and we all miss her. It was great for you that you worked for her for so long. Our therapy is really quite effective. Basically, it's a nutritional approach to cancer and other degenerative diseases. It involves three individualized components. Individualized diet. A lot of alternative doctors have one diet that they use for everybody. We have different diets, 10 basic diets, dozens of variations. Second component, individualized supplement protocols of vitamins, minerals, trace elements, et cetera. And for cancer patients, as you know, we use large doses of pancreatic enzymes derived from animal sources. And the third component, which in the conventional world is the most controversial, of course, is the detoxification routines like the famous coffee enemas. So basically, our therapy involves diet, supplements, detoxification regimens, and we've been using it now in practice for 25 years with great and gratifying success.
Yes, and I definitely have met literally hundreds of patients who have benefited from these therapies. Why don't we go a little bit more into the diets? Name a couple of the diets and why you as a physician would choose one over another for a specific individual.
Yeah, the 10 basic diets range from a raw foods, kind of plant-based diet with lots of fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains. Rarely do we prescribe a purely vegetarian diet. Even in the more plant-based diets, we allow some eggs and some yogurt. And there are gradations of vegetarian diets. Some involve fish and poultry. Some we allow occasional red meat. Then we have our carnivores, as we call them, are genetic meat eaters that actually won't do well unless they get a lot of fat and meat. These are the kind of patients that would do really well with Bob Atkins' approach, and the late Bob Atkins, who was a great advocate that, he made the mistake of thinking everyone should be on meat. Well, some patients actually do well on it. They just have a metabolism where they utilize fat, cholesterol, and saturated fat very efficiently in protein. So their diets might have red meat once, even twice a day, minimal fruit, if at all, some carbs, maybe occasional grains. In the extreme carnivore diets, we don't allow grains at all. And then we have all these variations of these diets. So they can range from pure plant-based, virtually plant-based raw foods, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, grains, to predominantly fatty red meat, and all gradations in between. Now, we have our own method of testing for the metabolism of patients to determine what kind of diet patients need. But in a simple sense, with cancer, you can generally tell just when a patient walks into the office if they have one of the typical solid tumors, like tumors of the breast, lung, stomach, colon, pancreas, liver, uterus, ovary, prostate. They always need to be on a plant-based type diet. The level of percentage of plant foods versus animal may vary, but they always need to be on a plant-based diet. Patients who come with immune cancers like leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, sarcomas, which are connective tissue tumors that are related to immune cancers, they need to be on a meat diet. And never do we see the opposite. Never do we have a sarcoma or a leukemia patient that needs to be on a vegetarian diet, or vice versa, breast cancer patient.
Oh, that's
patients.
Interesting. So the blood-based kind of cancers you find do better with a meat-based diet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Genetically, they're geared for that.
And that's interesting, even if you look at things from a Chinese medical perspective, because they tend to be very way, way on the yin side in terms of being weak and pallid and... That's interesting that you find that that helps them more. So what a wonderful thing. Isn't it amazing to you as a knowledgeable physician that in conventional medicine, diet is not even discussed?
Well, they discuss it, but usually incorrectly. They tuned in to think everybody should be on the same diet, and they when they do think about diet. But traditionally, they haven't thought about diet at all. It's very interesting. The average doctor who has a car wouldn't think twice, but they put the best fuel into their car. They wouldn't think twice if they have a Mercedes. They're going to put diesel fuel into it. They get the best octane gas for their car. They wouldn't think of putting sand into it or water. You know, if you have a steam engine, you put water into it, and it works fine. You put gasoline into a steam engine, it blows up. You put water into a car, you've just ruined your car. The doctors take more care of their cars than they do of their own bodies or their patients' bodies. They don't realize food is fuel, and each body needs the exact right fuel in order to metabolize, in order for efficient metabolism. They need the right fuel, and food is fuel. And no doctor in this country would put the wrong fuel into their car. They'll be meticulous about getting the best quality gasoline or diesel fuel from their local distributor. But when it comes to their own bodies, you know, they're eating, the doctors themselves are eating ice cream, drinking coffee. It's as if some magical process occurs with our bodies, which are the most extraordinary engine on earth, that you don't have to worry about the quality or the quantity of fuel that you put into it. But like any other engine, we need the right fuel or we're not going to function efficiently. And it shouldn't be so surprising. It's such a simple analogy, but doctors just don't understand that. They think there's some magical process that all the millions of processes that go on in our body every day don't require optimal nutrition. I just don't understand that. Everything that we are, every component of every cell in our body, every reaction, every enzyme comes only from one place, from our food. And if you eat lousy food, you're going to have lousy metabolism. If you have good fuel, you're going to have good metabolism. It's that simple, but doctors just cannot seem to understand that.
Do you support, like, organic food, any consciousness about what, you know, the quality of the food is with your patients?
Absolutely. I've been eating organically for over 30 years, and it absolutely makes a difference. We see patients that eat predominantly organically do better. It shouldn't be surprising. Pesticides and neurotoxins. Who wants to be taking in neurotoxins? Then you get the whole issue now of GMOs, which has become a nightmare over the last 10 years. GMOs, the genetically modified foods, are nightmarish. They're toxic. They produce all kinds of aberrations in our normal flora and our normal metabolism. Organic is the only way to go. I know there was that study about a month ago that said there's no difference in nutritional quality between organic and regular produce. But you look at that study, it was what's called a meta-analysis. People don't understand that, and the media didn't explain it because the media doesn't understand it. A meta-analysis, not actually a study. What a meta-analysis involves is that a scientist will go back through past studies and then come to some sort of conclusion. I think they looked at 17 different studies. Well, what predictably they did is the guy who was running it left off any of the positive studies that would have shown benefit to organic. He said he forgot to include them. Well, good, then the article should be yanked. It should be, you know, the article was an invalid article. So there's data going back to the 1920s showing that organically raised food is not only more nutritious, but it's actually more resistant to insects and fungal diseases. Sir Albert Howard was the great English researcher who spent a lot of his time in India and found that traditional composting organic techniques among the Indian farmers produced a very nutritious quality food. And he actually compared the nutritional value of the organically raised food to the conventionally westernized type food with the synthetic pesticides. And even in those days, there were pesticides and synthetic fertilizers. And not only was it healthier, but it was more resistant to insects and infectious type diseases that affect crops.
You're so right, Dr. Gonzalez. And I do want to state, in terms of the study you're just referring to, which came out recently called Are Organics Foods Safer or Healthier Than Conventional Alternatives? And it is a systemic review, and it was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It's, you know, just the other week people saw headlines. What's interesting is I read that study for myself, and they have three conclusions. One conclusion is that consumption of organic food may significantly reduce exposure to pesticide residues by 30%. Consumption of organic food significantly reduces the risk of exposure to antibiotic-resistant disease causing bacteria by 33%. And then they did say that there was not strong evidence about the higher nutritional value, which I don't think is true. But they could have chosen any of the other outcomes to blow up on media as a title to everything instead of focusing on the thing they could not prove. So there was a lot of, you know, who is paying for the PR agency who released those headlines? That's the interesting thing.
Well, it was done at Stanford, and Stanford notoriously is as well-respected an institution as it is. It's highly funded by people like Monsanto and the pharmaceutical industry.
Look at the timing of it, like you said, because there is a vote, of course, coming up in California about labeling GMO. So it was very right.
And I read that the person in charge of that study, though I don't have independent confirmation, actually was taking money from the cigarette industry 25, 30 years ago to try and downplay the dangers of cigarette smoking. He's a guy out of medical school doing that. So the study, as far as I'm concerned, wasn't a valid study because they left off, as it later came out after it was published, he left off articles that showed there was a benefit nutritionally to organic food. And Sir Albert Howard's work going back 60, 70 years is impeccable. And he clearly defined and clearly demonstrated the nutritional advantage of organically, traditionally raised crops and livestock over the conventionally westernized, synthetically, chemically and raised crops. There's no question about it. And this has been documented and proven over and over again. Textbooks have been written on it, but this guy didn't include any of that information in his article. He's totally unaware of it, I would gather.
That is so true, and it's so wonderful that there are doctors like you that look at the truth and are able to help people. Now, of course, you're a conventionally trained physician. We read your bio, and then you did work where you investigated Dr. Kelly.
Yeah.
So what did you find when you were investigating his work?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. You know, I went to Cornell because Cornell Medical School is here in Manhattan. The main campus, as you know, is up in Ithaca, but the medical school is here in the east side of Manhattan. And one of its teaching institutions is Memorial Sloan Kettering, the preeminent cancer research institution in the world. And I went to Cornell because I wanted to work at Sloan Kettering, spend the rest of my life there. And I specifically wanted to work under Robert Good, who was then president of Sloan Kettering, the most published author in the history of medicine, the guy who did the first bone marrow transplant in history in 1969. He was on the cover of Time magazine, 1972, all of that stuff. And that's the guy I wanted to work under. Well, second year of medical school, he kind of adopted me into his research group as a mascot and was nurturing my fledgling research career, and I had my whole life planned out. End of the second year of medical school, I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Kelly, who happened to be traveling through New York at that time. And I met, and we talked for several hours, and he seemed very intent. I was really kind of a conventional medical student at the time. I mean, I really wanted to spend my life in basic science at Sloan. And I had the opportunity to meet Kelly, but I had an open mind, and I listened to what he said, and it was clear to me several things. First, that he was very, very devoted to his work, very devoted to his patients. He wasn't some kind of sleazy quack, as was often portrayed, trying to steal money from unsuspecting cancer victims, which is the usual hyperbole that's disseminated in the press. But a very sincere practitioner who thought he was doing something valuable, and he was extremely frustrated that he saw patients get well, but the medical community could have cared less, in fact, was trying to get rid of him and undermine his practice. So I went to Dr. Good the day I met him, actually, the day I met Kelly. I went up to Dr. Good, met at the Sloan Kettering president's office. We talked for several hours about my meeting. He encouraged me to do a research investigation into Kelly. It was the summer after my second year of medical school, so I had a couple free months to do independent research. He said, why don't you go through Kelly's records? He said, even if Kelly turned out to be a charlatan, you'll learn a lot of medicine by doing a project of your own design. Good was a very good teacher. More of his students have gone on to professorships in medical school than out of any group in the history of medicine. So the next day I was on a plane to Dallas where Kelly had his records and started going through his records. And from the first day, even, you know, I was a second year medical student. I wasn't a highly proficient physician, but I knew enough medicine to know what was a good cancer case and not a good cancer case. And immediately I found dozens of cases with appropriately diagnosed advanced or terminal cancer who were alive, apparently 5 and 10 years later. And Kelly gave me access to these patients where I could actually call them and hear their stories. And I spent 2-3 weeks down in Dallas gathering records, copied them, brought them back to Dr. Good, and he said he had not seen cases like this, including pancreatic cancer patients alive 5 years later. So what started as a simple student project developed into a full-fledged research study, which I continued through medical school. In fourth year, I had 4 months of independent study under Dr. Good, where I continued my research. And then after my formal training, I joined Good's group as a research fellow. And he had moved to University of Oklahoma at that point to set up a cancer research institute, and then eventually University of South Florida, where again he set up a cancer research unit. And I followed him from Oklahoma to Florida, finishing my fellowship in bone marrow transplantation, which is ironic because that's about as conventional medicine as you can get, and cancer immunology. And meanwhile, Good supported my investigation at Kelly. And in 1986, we finished it, and I put it together in a monograph form, which we weren't able to publish because...
Why not? No, why were you not able to publish it?
Well, we got two responses from editors, both trade editors and technical editors, and we even tried to get some case reports published in the medical journals. The general response was this could not be real, that no nutritional... This is 1986, before alternative medicine was more accepted, that no unconventional alternative nutritional therapy could possibly do this, therefore it had to be fake. Even though in the monograph, I wrote up 50 patients of 26 different types of cancer, all properly diagnosed. And we actually had copies of the medical records there, and the patients had given me full permission to use their names. So we didn't even block out their names. It was right there. And these patients were available if anyone wanted to interview them. But they just believed it was fake. They just couldn't accept it. It was too emotionally upsetting. And that's when I began to realize that people that go into academic medicine aren't these objective seekers of the truth trying to help mankind and advance civilization through their discoveries. They're really driven by ego and self-aggrandizement. And they don't want someone else to have an answer to this terrible disease. If they can't figure it out, they don't want someone else coming up with this, especially if it's so foreign to the model in which they were trained. You know, most people go into cancer research are trained to think that drug therapy is the way you have to go. Here was this guy, Kelly, with his nutritional program reversing pancreatic cancer, advanced breast cancer, metastatic endometrial cancer.
And these are severe. This isn't like, you know, a phase one breast cancer.
No. We were looking for the worst. Good said it'd be a waste of time to do that. We had to find really sick patients. I'll give you an example of a patient whom I still follow. I interviewed her in 1986. She, in 1982, August 1982, she developed some abdominal pain, discomfort, reflux. They thought she had gallbladder disease. She was in Appleton, Wisconsin, where she and her husband ran a gas station. Went to surgery. They opened her up. Yeah, she had gallbladder disease, but she had a tumor in her pancreas and a tumor in her liver. They biopsied the liver lesion, came back adenocarcinoma, which is the aggressive form of pancreatic cancer, stage 4, took out her gallbladder, but then closed her up. She met with an oncologist who said, there's really nothing we can do. We can give you chemo, but it won't work. She went to the Mayo Clinic, where they reviewed the slides, confirmed that this was stage 4 pancreatic cancer, the most aggressive. They said you might have 6 months to a year, maybe a little longer if you're lucky. But I admire the Mayo Clinic, because if a therapy isn't of value, they won't promote it. And the oncologist said to her, said, chemo would be a total waste of your time. Just go and enjoy your life. Because of that decision, she didn't do standard therapy, started looking into alternatives, learned about Kelly, did the program. And when I interviewed her in 1986, she was already 4 years out with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, usually gone in 3 or 4 months. So she was already a miracle case. I follow her today. She considers me her doctor. She's now, as of August 2012, she's now 30 years out with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. To put that in perspective to your listeners, I have searched the literature. I mean, I was trained as an academician. I know how to go through the literature. I have never found another case of stage 4 pancreatic cancer with biopsy-proven liver metastases confirmed at the Mayo Clinic at a major institution who's alive 30 years later. There's no other case in the history of medicine. And those are the kind of cases we had in the book. And the editors just couldn't believe it.
I know. It just seems that they don't want to know about cures. It's just amazing. But it is certainly fortunate for that person that they didn't just go ahead and give her a course of chemo anyway, knowing that it would not be helpful, because that could have put her over the edge and actually killed her, which it often does.
Now, when she went to the Mayo Clinic, she was looking to be treated by them. She wasn't interested in alternatives at that point. That Mayo Clinic oncologist saved her life, because had he suggested chemo, she would have done it, and she would have died like everybody else with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. You know, there was a study on the newest chemo for pancreatic cancer, gemcitabine, published in 1997, still the standard of care chemo regimen. Out of 126 patients, not one lived longer than 19 months, but the average survival went from 4.5 to 5.6 months, so they considered it a great advance. The FDA approved it within a year. It's now a billion-dollar industry based on the fact that no one was cured, no one lived longer than 19 months. Here's a patient who lived 30 years. Had that oncologist at the Mayo said, do chemo, she'd have done it and she'd have died. So the fact that he was honest saved her life.
So I want to take a little break right here so that we can hear about other shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. We'll take a little station break, a station ID here, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion, and I do want you to know you're listening to Dr. Gonzalez, and you can find him at dr-gonzalez.com, and we'll be back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back once again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're here with you every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knoll's station. And you can catch us on the archives anytime, 24/7 on the archives at prn.fm. Today, we're very happy to have as our guest Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, MD. I'm sure many of you are familiar with him. He has a private practice in New York City, treating patients diagnosed with cancer and other serious degenerative illnesses. His nutritional research has received substantial financial support, and we're going to talk about why, from Procter & Gamble, Nestle, and the National Cancer Institute. And Dr. Gonzalez has written a major volume about his research called What Went Wrong? The Truth Behind the Clinical Trial of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. Now, Dr. Gonzalez, welcome back to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
It's great to be here.
You have so much information to share. I don't really know where to start, but I do want to focus on your book. Now, why is it called What Went Wrong instead of What Went Right?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've been fortunate, as you suggested in your introduction there, that we've been funded by industry, which is kind of unusual, as you say, as well as by government. Now, you know, I come out of a very orthodox academic background, as I continually repeat, because I'm interested in doing real science in the best way, in the best of traditions of science. And that's simply a way of trying to find the truth about a therapy, whether it's moondust, chemo, or my therapy. And after I met Kelly and did that 5-year research study of his work and realized he was doing something better, even though I had to change my life and I was offered 2 jobs at Sloan Kettering, which I had to turn down because it would require giving up my Kelly research, I refused to do that, opened up my practice. But my intention was always to get research funding to do clinical studies, because I believe in the purity of science when it's done properly, because that's how you can distinguish the truth from something that isn't true. Well, in 1993, the NCI, National Cancer Institute, invited me down to Washington as part of their initial, what seemed to be well-intentioned attempts to start evaluating promising alternative therapies. And I was invited to a 3-hour session with top-ranking officials at the NCI and the NIH, and I presented 25 cases. Based on that, they asked me to proceed with a pilot study, which is basically a small phase 2 study in which you use a new therapy with a cancer for which there is no standard therapy that works. And they said, take pancreatic cancer. With a pilot study, you don't need a lot of patients. They said 10 would be adequate to make the point. And the then associate director, Michael Friedman, said, if you can get 3 out of 10 to live 1 year, we'll consider that remarkable. Well, Nestle,
I would say.
Yeah, great. These were advanced patients, you know, mostly stage 4. We eventually had 11 patients. We added an 11th when one dropped out. In 1999, we published the results, and they were the best results, as you said earlier, in the history of medicine. he wanted 3 out of 10 to live a year. He said that'd be remarkable. We had 9 out of 11 lived 1 year, 5 lived 2 years, 4 lived 3 years, and 2 lived to 5 years, which was unheard of for inoperable pancreatic cancer. And there was an editorial accompanying my article in the journal in which it was published, Nutrition and Cancer, which is a peer-reviewed standard conventional research journal, saying this was, you know, remarkable. As a result of that, as a result of the preliminary data, actually the article hadn't been published, but the preliminary data was made available to the NCI because they were supervising this indirectly. The data was made available to them, and based on that, the then director of the NCI, Richard Klausner, called me down to Washington and met with him for 2 hours, eye to eye. And I absolutely believe he wanted a fair, honest, major phase 3 study of my therapy, in which my therapy would be compared to the best chemo in the treatment of patients with advanced pancreatic cancer. And he challenged me. He said, would you be willing to take that on? It's the worst cancer there is. Most oncologists wouldn't put their reputations on the line for that. I said, absolutely, because the pilot study is already showing it works. So we got funding for that. It was to be run out of Columbia University. Initially, there was a lot of optimism that this would be the final breakthrough study where conventional alternative practitioners come together for the benefit of the truth, for the benefit of patients. And initially, the team assigned to that study, I believe, really intended to do a fair and honest study. Unfortunately, Klausner left to go off into a private foundation, and the new team that was assigned to the study, I believe, had a completely different agenda. There was one woman who was initially assigned who was very supportive of the study and thought I was doing remarkable work, who was told she could no longer talk to me, and that if she took a phone call from me, she would be fired. She was,
wait a minute. Yeah. I don't understand it. They've already sent you a grant. They're already part of working on this project. How did that happen?
Well, I think the new team that came in absolutely thought that what I did could not possibly produce good results, and that they had to do some. In fact, there was something. We had to have meetings with the NCI and the NIH people every 3 months. They were held at Columbia, and the NIH and NCI team would fly up. And in one of the meetings, one of the people from the NIH, an oncologist, kind of let something out that we have to get results out to counter the positive results of the pilot study. So by saying that, he was essentially letting me know, and I think that was just a slip of the tongue that he let me know what was going on, that the new team that was assigned to the study had their marching orders that we had to counter the positive Gonzalez pilot study, because that's as he said, that's the only information out there. We got to counter that. He actually used the word counter. So Dr. Isaacs and I looked at each other after that meeting. We're taking a cab back to our office in New York after that meeting at Columbia. I said, boy, things have changed. Now, we suspect that they were hoping we would quit. Then they could use the usual refrain that alternative doctors don't have the guts, the intelligence, the morality, the ethics to do pilot studies, that they just quit because they don't have therapies that work and they don't want to stand up to scrutiny. But we weren't going to quit. We were going to call their bluff. We were going to stay on that study and make sure they did it right. Well, they didn't do it right. That was the problem. This study went on from about 19, well, the first protocol was written in 1997, 1998. It ended around 2006. The last patient was entered 2005. And from the beginning, there were problems. The first thing that happened is initially we were going to, with the team that was supportive of the study, Dr. Isaacs and I, my colleague Dr. Isaacs and I, were allowed to be involved with the selection of patients. Patient selection is critical for a clinical study. They have to meet certain predetermined criteria, which are defined in writing in the actual protocol. But the NCI said if Gonzalez and Isaacs are involved in the selection of patients, this will add a bias. So we were forbidden from having any say in the selection of patients. We thought, well, we've been doing this therapy for 15 years. Wouldn't our insight be valuable? They said, no, you have nothing to do with selection of patients. All selection was put in the hands of John Chabot, the chief researcher at Columbia, who was a surgeon. And what we did not know at the time, but we learned later, is that he actually helped develop the chemo regimen that was being used against us, which is a clear conflict of interest. The principal investigator has to be completely objective and uninvolved, either financially or intellectually, with either of the therapies being tested. And he had a clear conflict of interest.
Okay, so you're saying that they were comparing it to a chemo regimen that he was involved with producing or selecting.
The chief, even though he was a surgeon, he was involved with it, and the chief oncologist was a friend of his. Because this regimen, which I didn't realize at the time because no one told me, had actually been developed right at Columbia by their oncology team working with the principal investigator on my study. He was in charge of selecting patients. Now, there were very specific criteria for determine if patients are eligible or not. One of them, of course, ours is a nutritional program. It's not intravenous. Patients have to be able to eat. They have to follow a diet and have to be able to get supplements down. We're not naive. We know what we can do and what we can't do. If patients can't eat, they can't do our therapy. And into the root.
So wait 1 second. If someone were to come to your office and they were not able to do it, then would you just
We turn people down who can't eat, and they get angry with us. But there's no point. It's not to their benefit for us to mislead them and imply we can help them when we can't. So when we select patients in our private practice, we have a whole process we go through. We don't just immediately make appointments. We select patients. And if they can't eat, and a lot of really advanced cancer patients can't eat, they can't do our therapy. That's one of the limitations. So we turn people like that down. And that was written into the protocol. If patients can't eat, they can't be accepted. Repeatedly, the principal investigator entered patient after patient that was unable to eat to be treated by us. We had patients that never even took a supplement. Now, there was a trick, a clause into the protocol that made that a very dangerous situation, because there was what was called an intent to treat clause. In clinical studies, an intent to treat provision means that the minute a patient is accepted into the study, they're considered treated, even if they never did the therapy. So we had this odd situation where patients were being referred to us who couldn't eat, who couldn't do the treatment, who actually dropped out. Several of them actually went off and got chemo, and they died. And they were considered Gonzalez treatment failures. We had one patient who tried for several weeks to do the program, couldn't do it, went off and got chemo, died, as they always do on chemo, and he's considered a Gonzalez treatment failure by that intent to treat provision, that the second the principal investigator accepted the patient into the study, they were considered as fully treated. And we argued against that. We knew it was going to work against us. And most nutritional or lifestyle clinical studies have a provision where if the patient can't follow the program, they're dismissed from the study and they're not included in the final data. In our study, we had this intent to treat provision. Of 39 patients ultimately entered into our arm to get nutritional therapy, we estimate maybe 5 or 6 did it at all to any extent, and only several did it completely. And they were the longest survivors, actually. When the study ended in 2006, the two longest survivors were our patients, one at 3.5 years, one at 2 years, 8 months, who had multiple lesions in the liver. And she actually
Wait a minute. Let's repeat that again. You're going very, very fast, Dr. Gonzalez. I don't want people to miss these important points. So even with this interfering and competitive protocols that may or may not, whatever it looks like, were going on, still some of the patients treated with your therapy survived.
The patients that were able to do it got responses, and at the time the study ended, 2005, 2006, the two longest survivors were our patients by far. 3.5 years. To put that in perspective, I mentioned earlier GEMSAR, which is the standard of care chemo treatment for pancreatic cancer. In the classic GEMSAR study from the mid-90s of 126 patients treated, not one lived longer than 19 months. In our little group of 5 or 6 that did it, we had two lived 2 years, 8 months with stage 4 disease and only died because her oncologist convinced her to quit the study and go do chemo. And the other one, who died 3.5 years into it, and he died not because of cancer, but he had a hernia repair that got infected, and he ended up with infection all through his fascia in his abdominal cavity and died of infection. And it had nothing to do with his cancer. It was just a freak surgical accident. He lived out in Ohio, and the surgeon there didn't catch the infection fast enough. But even with those qualifications, the two longer survivors were our patients. So that alone, you know, should have warranted FDA approval for a treatment. But repeatedly, the principal investigator entered patients not only who couldn't eat, but who didn't meet other criteria. For example, any lifestyle clinical study precludes patients with mental illness. It isn't that we're trying to be cruel or, you know, we don't feel sorry for these terribly struggling, you know, terribly difficult patients. But they can't follow a nutritional program. Patients who are actively mentally ill can't follow the program. Three of the patients who entered had to, in our estimation, clear evidence of they were on powerful antidepressants, antipsychotic medications. They should never have been entered into the study, and none of those three patients could do it. Yet they were considered Gonzalez treatment failures. Another qualification, which is very basic, all patients had to be entered within 8 weeks of diagnosis. We're dealing with advanced pancreatic cancer, inoperable pancreatic cancer. The average survival is 3, 4, 5 months with inoperable disease. They had to be entered within 8 weeks, which I thought was too liberal. They should have been entered within a couple of weeks. Well, the majority of patients were entered 8 weeks, and a number of them even beyond 8 weeks, even though the protocol required that they be entered within 8 weeks. The principal investigator entered three patients who were diagnosed 10, even 11 weeks from diagnosis. And I complained about it, and he said, too bad. And when I complained to the NCI, they said, too bad. If you don't like it, quit the study. And that's when
you have a whole chapter on each of these things. I do want to alert our audience what went wrong, the truth behind the clinical trial of the enzyme treatment of cancer. Each point that you're bringing up, like you have a whole chapter, chapter 12, admission of patients who did not fulfill some of the entry criteria.
That's right. And something like the 8-week requirement is not an opinion, or it's not open to judgment. Either they were diagnosed 8 weeks they're diagnosed 8 weeks ago, or they weren't. But it didn't matter to the chief investigator. He was entering patients beyond 8 weeks, which was a clear protocol violation. And that's just, that had to be deliberate because I warned him. What was the point of that, to enter
patients? Now, why weren't you more involved in actually, you know, being on board as a major consultant and deciding physician as the trial moved along?
In 2000, in the year 2000, the NCI came to New York. We met with one of their high-ups who said, you can't have, looking at me and Dr. Isaacs, you can have nothing to do with the entry of patients, that it's up to John Chabot, the principal investigator. Your involvement would create, this is the irony, our involvement would create bias. Meanwhile, they put the guy in charge who helped develop the chemo regimen, and we could have nothing to do with it. So I complained. I complained in writing. As you can see in the book, I have all the documentation there. We left a paper trail that could fill a room, but they just ignored it. They didn't care. And I guess their thinking was, because I'm alternative, no one in the media will take me seriously. They'll think I'm just some crazy alternative guy complaining because this therapy, this joke therapy with coffee enemas, doesn't work. But we were relentless. We created a paper trail so big that ultimately we were able to write the book and document all these things, because we have it all, you know, the emails and the letters and all our interchange with these people at Columbia and the NCI and the NIH. So you can't deny the truth there.
You do. You have instances in which Dr. Isaacs and or Dr. Gonzalez argued against the entry of patients that were approved.
And they just ignored it. They could have cared less. The other thing, that was deliberate, but there was another component, which is how we finally got them, is that not only, I guess they were arrogant and they were just incompetent. Any federally funded study requires every patient entered to a clinical trial must sign informed consent. Even the World Health Organization, the UN, have gotten involved with informed consent in clinical studies. You know, the Nuremberg trials, you know, with the horrors of Nazism showed what can happen when medicine runs amok and patients aren't protected in clinical studies. So there's a whole criteria and a whole procedure for guaranteeing that patients have to sign and are informed orally about what's going on in the study, what the risks, the benefits are, that this is an experimental protocol. All that is supposed to be explained. All that was supposed to be done by Chabot's office up at Columbia. Well, Dr. Isaacs, to her credit, picked up on some of these patients that they didn't appear to be properly informed. And when, sure enough, we started to demand the informed consent documents, and for three patients, they didn't exist. And this is a clear violation not only of our protocol, but of federal regulation. And they came up with all sorts of excuses. What's so comical is the excuses change. Once they said, well, they had been misplaced by a substitute nurse who was involved with the protocol during a vacation period. Another time that the patients walked off with the consent forms. Well, how can they walk off? You're not supposed to walk off with the consent forms. You're supposed to sign them. Or if you don't sign them, you're not entered into the study. There were all these cockamamie reasons, and they would just make up new reasons as we went along. So finally, in 2006, as you know, it's in the book, I filed a complaint with the Office of Human Research Protections, which is the oversight group at the NIH responsible for the ethical and appropriate management of federally funded clinical studies. Now, believe me, in my interactions with them, you know, I don't think they had any love for alternative medicine, but we provide them with hundreds of pages of documents. And what we provided them was the documentation that informed consent hadn't been done properly. And that forced them to start an investigation. It took 2 years, you know, government bureaucracy being what it is. It took them 2 years. And lo and behold, they found indeed that 42 out of 62 patients had not been properly entered, including 40 patients who were not properly consented. Now, they didn't adjudicate things like whether this was deliberate or fraud. That's not their area of jurisdiction. But the FDA then got involved. You know, the FDA initially had to sign off on this study, you know, and I realized in the alternative world, the FDA has looked like some kind of, you know, enemy. But in my case, they signed off on this clinical study within 2 months. I mean, they could have delayed it for 2 years the way they do with drug company studies. But they didn't. They approved it very quickly, and they really didn't interfere, try and undermine it. But once they signed off on it, when there was evidence of mismanagement, they felt obligated to get involved. And in 2009, they did a site visit at Columbia, and they did their own investigation, and they vindicated my complaints, and it's on their FDA website, and they name Chabot as the perpetrator. They say he didn't follow the written protocol, which was one of our complaints, that he didn't keep accurate or complete records, which is the kiss of death for a clinical study. The whole point of a clinical study is you keep accurate and complete records. He didn't do informed consent properly, and there was another thing they found, which was less significant. Now, again, the FDA didn't adjudicate whether this was a deliberate attempt to sabotage my treatment, but they did vindicate my complaints that the principal investigator at Columbia, this esteemed academician working with the esteemed NCI and NIH, didn't run the study properly. Now, we thought that someone needed to get involved to determine whether this was deliberate and whether this is a deliberate attempt to undermine, and we had evidence that records were being changed, but they didn't get into that. It seemed like everyone was afraid to do that. And here's where they covered the wagons. They were willing to give us mismanagement, but Chabot was still, as you know, because you looked at the book, was able to publish an article saying the study was properly run and my therapy didn't work, even though the two major federal groups, the OHRP, Office of Human Research Protections, and the FDA, found it hadn't been properly managed. No article should ever have been published on the study. It wasn't managed properly. The data isn't reliable. So when we realized that the government organizations, as much as they did vindicate our complaints, was not going to really go after Columbia, and there was no real punishment. I mean, ironically, the Columbia team was required to undergo training in research methodology. I think it's kind of ironic when you think about it. Based on a complaint of the alternative crazy fringe people, the esteemed academicians at the Ivy League Medical School had to undergo retraining in proper clinical trial management. So they did take our complaint seriously. But there was no punishment like loss of funding to Columbia or Chabot was fired, nothing like that at all. So that's why we ultimately wrote the book, when we realized, as usual in dealing with the government, you're kind of on your own. So we published the book where people can read it and all the documentation is there. And it may seem like this is kind of an esoteric thing, a book about my particular clinical study, but what it really is, it's a book about corruption at the NCI and NIH, the government academic of institution, right up to the highest level.
Let's talk more about, you know, because we actually have a few minutes left. We have about a little less than 10 minutes or so, but I don't want to not talk about your actual therapy and how wonderful it is, because, of course, you called this What Went Wrong. And the only reason I'll tell you I don't like that title, Dr. Gonzalez, is because I know for a fact so many, hundreds of people where it went right, and they actually are alive today because of your therapies.
That's true, and the title really refers to the clinical study and everything that happened around that. I mean, this was an extraordinary opportunity from the NCI and the NIH to do what we originally intended they should do. And I believe the original team and Dr. Klausner at the NCI wanted a fair and honest study, and here was an opportunity to get a non-toxic, cheap, our therapy is like 1/10, 1/20, 1/50 the cost of chemo, cheap, non-toxic, effective treatment into the mainstream. If people want to do chemo and radiation and keep smoking and drinking and not change their diet, fine. I love that. Mm-hmm. People can do what they want. But it should be made available, and it should have been properly investigated. And
do you think there's anything behind this, such as the pharmaceutical and chemo industry would really rather not have your kind of therapy around?
I've been told that. Certainly I'm not an unknown commodity at this point. People in industry know about me, and I have friends in industry like Procter & Gamble and Nestle of all places. I mean, I've top flight researchers that really believe in my work and have managed to get these companies, even though they're not seen as friends of alternative medicine, to support some of our research, for which I'm very grateful, and they let us do the research properly. They've told me that drug companies know about you, and then they've had meetings about me. I don't think the outcome of the meeting was less supportive. First of all, what we do isn't patentable. It's all nutrition. By the current regulations, nutritional therapies really can't be patented. There's no big profit. You know, Avastin, which is a mediocre drug for the treatment of advanced cancer, recently the FDA pulled it in terms of breast cancer because it wasn't doing anything. It costs $10,000 a month. My whole therapy doesn't cost, including all the supplements and my office visits, it might cost $10,000-$11,000 for the first year, which is the most expensive, and then it's cheaper as you go along. There's bone marrow transplant, which I was trained to do, can cost up to $500,000 and even more. Can get into $1 million in certain circumstances. Enormous profit in these things. There's not the kind of profit in my therapy. It can't be patented. There's no reason for a drug company based on current law, patent law, to invest money in our therapy for any length of time because they can't patent the end result.
Now, what kind of enzymes are you using? Are there special brands that you recommend? Do you have them made for your office specifically?
Our pancreas product is made for us specifically for our office. Now, because of FDA regulations, I can't be out there promoting it and telling people to buy enzymes, so I can't do that. And the FDA has specific regulations about the use of the word enzyme. If you're going to call a product an enzyme, it has to go through all kinds of million-dollar testing. So you are allowed to have pancreas products over-the-counter as long as you don't make claims for it, as long as you don't call it an enzyme. So our product is called pancreas glandular tissue. It's basically a pancreas supplement. It is made by a special process. Now, one of the reasons I'm so grateful to Procter & Gamble during the 1990s, they allocated millions of dollars in a research team to help me perfect the manufacturing process for our pancreas product, and they were extremely helpful, and we were able to perfect it. Most of the enzymes or enzyme products or pancreas products available either as prescription forms or over-the-counter are made by an old process developed in 1950 by the biochemist Ezra Levin, but it's a process that involves toxic alcohol extractions and all that. We wanted to find a natural process that would produce a stable product. Interestingly enough, most of the traditionally manufactured enzyme preparations aren't very stable on the shelf. Pancreatic enzymes are very active, and they're digestive enzymes, and they can digest cancer, and they can digest food, but they can also digest each other. So on the shelf, they start auto-digesting, and you end up with a worthless collection of amino acids rather than active enzymes. So we wanted to develop a method that produced a stable product that had a specific level of activity and that would last on the shelf. And we've had old lots tested 5 years later that has the same level of activity. And with Procter & Gamble's assistance, we were able to do that. They're made for us in New Zealand. New Zealand is still the cleanest place on earth, and they have the strictest laws for raising animals. And they've never had mad cow trichinosis or any of those things. So we get clean stuff out of New Zealand. A lot of the commercial preparations are made from animals raised in the Omaha feedlots. We use a pig-based source because the pig pancreas is most like the human pancreas. You know, for years, endocrinologists used pig insulin to treat diabetes because it was most similar to the human insulin in terms of the amino acid sequence. The same is true with the pancreatic enzymes. The pig pancreatic enzymes are most like the humans, so we think they work best. We have lamb available for people that are allergic to pork or for religious reasons don't want to use pork. But the pork works best. So they're made for us. They slaughter the animals from the meat trade, and normally they would turn the pancreas into dog food or throw it away. We buy all these glands and organs, turn them into enzymes and other nutritional supplements. So they are made specially, and we have a process that's been used. And, you know, our goal with this research, that people could accuse me of being secretive and paranoid. Well, we're not secretive or paranoid. It's just we spent 8 years working with the NCI and the NIH hoping that they would vindicate our work. And then, as with any other accepted therapy, it would be made available to the world. But that wasn't to happen. So we're trying to figure out how to keep this therapy alive and expand it, because we get so many requests every day from people from all over the world wanting to be able to do our therapy, and we're trying to figure out how to start training people. You know, we relied on this clinical study to open up the gates to wider acceptance for a treatment and training programs and all. None of that is going to happen through the government.
Now, can people access you by getting in touch with your office, and that is at www.dr, for Dr. Gash-Gonzalez, GONZALEZ.com. That's probably the best way.
Yeah, they go to our website, and there's a section on how to become a patient and how to get our books. I mean, we've written three books, including What Went Wrong About the Clinical Study. One, Trophoblast, discusses the reasons why pancreatic enzymes have an anti-cancer effect. And then we did finally publish my investigation of Dr. Kelly, finally, in 2010. We rewrote it, put it a new introduction by current standards, and it's now available. And, you know, well, earlier you asked about, you know, you said hundreds of our patients that you're aware of have done well. One of the great patients actually wrote a foreword to the book, One Went Wrong. She was actually patient Dr. Isaacs. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. The first CAT scan was December 2000. The biopsy was February 2001, and confirmed at the Mayo Clinic. Aggressive histology pancreatic cancer. Never had surgery, chemo, and radiation. Came under Dr. Isaac's care. And now coming up to 12 years, she's alive and well. She leads a nutrition course at her local church. She's active with her family. She was given 6 months to live, maybe a year if she were lucky, back in 2000, 2001. And she wrote one of the forewords of the book, and it's really quite moving to hear her story. You know, she comes from Denver, Colorado, a really wonderful lady. And we have patients like that routinely. We have patients with pancreatic cancer that have been with us 20 years.
I do know, and I have met them, and we are at the end of our show just about Dr. Gonzalez, but, you know, that was just fascinating information, and I know you have specific protocols where you use the you talk about them as being enzymes, and I know people can use them with food to aid digestion, but then away from food to have the therapeutic action that you advise.
Correct. Yeah, I take about 25 a day because as I've gotten older and I work too hard, I can't get sick. I have to be in good health. So I follow my own program preventatively. I do coffee enemas. I eat organically. I have eaten organically for over 30 years. I take a huge batch of supplements. So I follow my own program, and I take pancreatic enzymes preventatively. And patients can go to the health food stores and get over-the-counter preparations and just
can
ask.
Can people get the enzymes from your clinic even if they're not part of a protocol? No. So
we don't sell
them as a product.
Unlike most alternative practitioners, we don't actually sell supplements. There is a distributor in California that sells them, but only to our patients. But if you go to the health food stores and ask the health food store owner for pancreatic products or supplements, whatever the technical term that the FDA requires, they'll know how to direct them, and they probably can point patients to the ones that are most similar to the ones we use in our clinic. But the ones we use in our practice are available through a distributor that only sells to our patients.
Thank you for a wonderful show and for all your work for so many years. It just shouldn't be a struggle with the amount of data you have, the amount of positive patient outcomes in a disease that really is a terminal kind of disease. There's no question in my mind that your work should be promoted widely and should be used as standard of care. There's just no question. Because when you do a comparison with the data, it's just so clear that everything you've done is cutting edge. And I know that it will triumph in the end because truth usually does at some point. At least we hope to think so.
Surprisingly enough, it does usually rise to the surface, and I agree with that.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. Again, listeners, we've been talking today with the very knowledgeable and esteemed Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. We've been talking about his book, What Went Wrong, The Truth Behind the Clinical Trial of the Enzyme Treatment of Cancer. But I want to leave you with the thought about what went right for all the patients who have accessed his phenomenal therapeutic knowledge. And again, that's Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez at dr-gonzalez.com, or get in touch with us, visit us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next week, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.